hypnotism, and astral projection. Dr. Thomas Garrett, a therapeutic hypnotist who pioneered in the treatment of shell-shocked soldiers in the First World War, told me of an outstanding experience he had had with one of his private patients. The young man, son of a famous Broadway playwright, came to Dr. Garrett emotionally upset over a broken romance. He submitted to hypnotism and told Dr. Garrett that he and his former fiancé, who was a student at Wellesley, had had a falling out over some trivial matter and she had returned his ring. Dr. Garrett, on impulse, told the hypnotized young man he could visit the woman he loved and see if he could determine how she now felt about him. Dr. Garrett explained he had the power to leave his physical body in his astral form and travel direct to Wellesley, to the sorority house where the young lady was residing. There was a moment of silence. Then the entranced subject announced that he was standing in the hall, outside the girl's closed door. "Don't let that stop you," said Dr. Garrett. "You can pass right through the door. Go on in and tell me what she's doing." After another moment, the young man said, "She is at her desk, writing a letter." "That's fine," said Dr. Garrett. "Look over her shoulder and read to me what she is writing." Almost instantly, the face of the sleeping subject took on a surprised and delighted expression. "Why, she's writing to me!" "What is she saying?" demanded Dr. Garrett, picking up a pencil. The young man then read to Dr. Garrett several word-for-word paragraphs to the effect that his sweetheart was sorry for her part in the lover's quarrel, was asking forgiveness, and expressing the hope for a reconciliation. The young man became so excited that he tried to embrace the girl, and the reaction on his physical body was such that Dr. Garrett quickly brought him back from his astral adventure and woke him up with the suggestion that he would remember all that had transpired. Late the following day, this young man received a special delivery letter from his sweetheart, the very letter he had either astrally or telepathically perceived. Dr. Garrett has this letter in his files, together with the notations he had made, as reported by his entranced subject. There were only a few words of variation between the two. An even more fantastic-sounding hypnosis story can be found in Michael Talbot's epic work, The Holographic Universe, one of the best collections of source field investigations ever committed to the printed page. Talbot witnessed his father's friend Tom being hypnotized in the early 1970s by a professional. The hypnotist told Tom his daughter Laura would be invisible to him when he came out of trance. He then had Laura stand directly in front of her father. Tom apparently saw right through her body as he woke up and gazed around the room, and he also could not hear her giggling. The hypnotist then pulled a watch out of his pocket and quickly pushed it into the small of Laura's back, keeping it concealed in his hand so no one could have seen what it was, and asked Tom if he could see what he was holding. Tom leaned forward, as if staring directly through Laura's stomach, and said it was a watch. The hypnotist nodded and asked if Tom could read the watch's inscription. Tom squinted, as if struggling to make out the writing, and recited both the name of the watch's owner, which happened to be a person unknown to any of us in the room, and the message. The hypnotist then revealed that the object was indeed a watch and passed it around the room so that everyone could see that Tom had read its inscription correctly. When I talked to Tom afterward, he said his daughter had been absolutely invisible to him. All he had seen was the hypnotist standing and holding a watch cupped in the palm of his hand. Had the hypnotist let him leave without telling him what was going on, he never would have known he wasn't perceiving normal consensus reality. I read this back in 1995, and it made a huge impression upon me. Tom's hypnotized mind could see right through his daughter as if she didn't even exist, and he could read detailed written inscriptions from a pocket watch. If true, this challenges everything we think we know about solid matter and suggests there is a part of our minds with vastly greater capabilities than most of us are ever aware of. What we think we see may be nothing more than the product of a collective decision we're all making to see it that way, a form of mass hypnosis. Remember, we can walk, talk, and interact with the world under hypnosis, travel out of body and make accurate observations, and may or may not have any conscious memory of what we did after we are brought out of trance. We can also be given post-hypnotic suggestion to act, think, or behave a certain way after we wake up. These suggestions are apparently powerful enough to make a human being utterly invisible to us while we're in an otherwise normal state of consciousness. When we discover that ordinary people can be hypnotized like this, we typically write it off as the work of the subconscious mind. But we still don't understand what exactly this is or why it works. The subconscious seems to automatically obey hypnotic commands, generally without question, as if it were quite accustomed to hearing orders and acting upon them. After his university training, Cleve Baxter eventually joined the U.S. Counterintelligence Corps and lectured on the potential danger of foreign powers using hypnosis to extract classified information from overseas government personnel. Baxter took a huge risk to demonstrate the seriousness of this subject to a high-ranking military officer. With her permission, Baxter hypnotized the secretary of the commanding general of the Counterintelligence Corps. While under hypnosis, he asked her to remove a highly classified document from the general's locked file cabinet, and she willingly obeyed. Baxter told her she would not remember what she had done when she awoke. And sure enough, she had no idea she had just leaked very sensitive information when he brought her back. That night, I secured the document in my locked file, and the next day presented it to the general. I explained to him that I might be risking a court-martial, but hoped instead to expedite further consideration of the importance of my research. Rather than a court-martial, on December 17, 1947, I received a very favorable letter of recommendation from the general, stating that my research was of high importance to military intelligence. Then, positive things started to happen. Early pioneer of the polygraph. After giving 10 days of hypnosis and sodium pentothal truth serum demonstrations at the Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C., Baxter began working for the Central Intelligence Agency as of April 27, 1948. Shortly after joining the CIA, Baxter studied with Leonard Keeler, a pioneer in the use of the polygraph. In addition to other classified activities, I was a key member of a CIA team that was prepared to travel to any foreign location to analyze the possible use of unusual interrogation tactics, including my original areas of concern, mainly hypno-interrogation and narco-interrogation. Back in Washington, D.C., the polygraph operation I had established was becoming popular for the screening of applicants for employment at the CIA and for some general screening of key CIA personnel. The ever-increasing schedule of rather routine polygraph examinations started to interfere with my more creative interests in research. Shortly after Leonard Keeler's death, circa 1951, Baxter left the CIA to serve as director of the Keeler Polygraph Institute in Chicago. This was the only classroom-type school teaching the use of the polygraph at the time. Baxter went on to start his own polygraph consultant business, working with several government agencies in Washington, D.C., and then expanded into a second office in Baltimore, Maryland. By 1958, Baxter had freed up the time to begin intensive polygraph research, and he developed the first standardized system for numerical evaluation of polygraph charts, which is still being used today. He moved to New York City in 1959 and continued to operate a commercial polygraph business. 7 years later, Baxter struck gold. In February 1966, an event occurred that was about to expand the entire focus of my research through a kind of paradigm shift in my own awareness. At the time of its occurrence, I had been involved in the use of the polygraph on humans for 18 years. Baxter's secretary purchased a rubber plant and a Dracaena cane plant from a store that was going out of business. This was the first time Baxter had ever owned any plants. On February 2, 1966, Baxter had worked through the night in his lab and finally took a coffee break at 7 a.m. In those weary hours, Baxter got an idea. He would try to connect his new Dracaena plant to the polygraph and see what happened. Much to his surprise, the plant did not have a smooth, flat pattern of electrical activity. It was surprisingly jagged and alive, changing moment to moment. Then, as Baxter kept watching in amazement, it got a whole lot more interesting. About 1 minute into the chart recording, the tracing exhibited a short-term change in contour similar to a reaction pattern typical of a human subject who might have been briefly experiencing the fear of detection. In simple language, the plant's electrical activity looked just like the graph from a person who was starting to tell a lie. Baxter knew that if you want to catch someone lying, you first have to confront them about whatever they might be hiding. If your questions then cause them to feel threatened and anxious, the electrical activity in their skin gets much stronger. Baxter wanted to see if he could get a human-like response out of his new plant by threatening its well-being somehow. An example of what we do with a human taking a polygraph test is to ask a question such as, "Did you fire that shot that was fatal to John Smith?" If they did commit the crime, that question threatens their well-being and produces a reaction that shows up on the chart. Baxter tried dipping one of the leaves into a cup of hot coffee. Nothing. He tapped one of the leaves with his pen. There was hardly any response. Then, after about 14 minutes of elapsed chart time, I had this thought. As the ultimate plant threat, I would get a match and burn the plant's electroded leaf. At that time, the plant was about 15 feet away from where I was standing. The only new thing that occurred was this thought. What happened next would change the history of science forever, and the impact still has not reached our common public awareness. The very moment the imagery of burning that leaf entered my mind, the polygraph recording pen moved rapidly to the top of the chart. No words were spoken, no touching the plant, no lighting of matches, just my clear intention to burn the leaf. The plant recording showed dramatic excitation. To me, this was a powerful, high-quality observation. I must state that on February 2, 1966, at 13 minutes 55 seconds into that chart recording, my whole consciousness changed. I then thought, gee, it's as though this plant read my mind. As the plant continued to have what would be considered an enormous, panicked reaction, Baxter then went and got matches from his secretary's desk. When I returned, the plant was still showing highly visible reactions. I made a feeble pass at a leaf with a lighted match, but by then, I was not really into harming the plant. I thought the best thing for me to do was to remove the threat and see if the plant would calm down. After returning the matches to my secretary's desk, the tracing finally returned to the calmness displayed prior to the original decision to burn the electroded leaf. As of 9 a.m., Baxter's associate Bob Henson came to work and was fascinated when he heard about what Baxter had just done. When Henson repeated the experiment and threatened the plant himself, the same reaction occurred. Baxter now felt sympathy for the plant and did not let Henson actually burn any of the leaves. In fact, Baxter never again did an experiment that involved burning or threatening to burn plants. A personal experience of the Baxter effect. In 2006, I called Baxter's research laboratory in San Diego to ask if he wanted to participate in a film shoot to dramatize this event in a modern classroom setting. Until I was actually on the phone with him, I did not realize that I had called on February 2nd, 2006, 40 years to the day from when he first made this discovery in 1966. Baxter agreed to do my movie. A few months later, we brought him up to Los Angeles and spent a healthy chunk of investor capital for a professional, Hollywood-level shoot. In this key scene, Baxter is invited to a college classroom to discuss his original experiment while he has a live plant connected to his polygraph. One rebellious student in the audience gets excited and impatient and wants to recreate the Baxter effect for himself. The kid jumps out of his seat with a lighter in his hand and runs toward the plant to burn it, but my character holds him back. The plant still screams from the fear of being burned, thus proving to the entire class that the Baxter effect really works. This was how I had written the scene. I had a significant amount of investor dollars on the line, and Baxter had promised to work as an actor and follow the script. To my horror, he refused to pretend that the plant was having a terrified reaction each time I held the kid back. We did take after take, but Baxter simply wouldn't act out his part unless he saw the graph actually go wild like he witnessed in his original discovery 40 years earlier. He obviously wasn't going to have any kind of authentic reaction on camera. I then realized the only way I could save my film was to use the Baxter effect myself. Up until then, we were only acting. There were no strong emotions going around. The kid didn't really want to burn the plant, and I knew he wasn't really going to try to push past me. The plant knew it wasn't in any real danger, so as a result, its graph stayed nice and smooth. I knew I had to do something, and fast. The next time we did the scene, I sent that plant the blackest, darkest thoughts I could possibly conjure up right when I confronted the kid. I really felt it deep down in my core. I absolutely hated that plant. I wanted to tear it to pieces, burn it to a crisp. Right at that exact moment, the polygraph needle went completely nuts, just like a person screaming in terror. With the camera still rolling, Baxter said, "Whoa, we got quite a reaction here." I saved the shoot and proved for myself that the Baxter effect really works. I then told the plant I was sorry, and I sent genuine feelings of love to it in case it could somehow hear me or feel me. The graph calmed right back down. Baxter let me save the graph paper from this stunning event, and I still have it in the box with all the bills we racked up from that day of shooting. The script went through many more changes, and we never ended up using our promo footage professionally. But I was very happy to get my own chance to experience the Baxter effect with the man himself and really know, deep down inside, that it works. I also will never forget the day I was speaking to my landlady and her 10-year-old daughter about Baxter's amazing discovery. Her daughter suddenly ran outside and started rolling around in the grass in total ecstasy, saying, "You can hear me! You can hear me!"